Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Two Narrows podcast. It's episode one in season two. And our first guest is Senator Lynn Ruane. Hello, Senator Lynn. How are you?
I'm good. Very good.
Thanks
a million to be in Cork.
We're delighted to have you. Thanks a million for coming to Churchfield, Northwest Cork City.
Yeah.
Back at Timmy's Gaff.
I felt so at home driving in. I was like,
Yeah, we knew you would.
Horses
over
there.
Let's hope the dogs know once they're back.
Dogs, lame face.
There's horses and sulkies and scramblers and all that sort of stuff. But as I was saying to you when we were in correspondence, there's a lot of similarities between Talla and this area. Can you tell us a little about Talla and maybe your early years?
Yeah, so Talla obviously it's huge. So when we talk about looking at spaces that are similar, it's kind of Talla West that would be more similar to where we are now. Like Dublin South County Council is the most affluent, richest county council, but it has some of the poorest estates in the whole country, you know. So statistically, it can look like it has plenty of money, but it definitely doesn't, or else it's not funneled towards us in West Talla. So I grew up in Kilnarden in Talla. I suppose like anyone, like the rest of the world didn't exist for me. It was just me and my estate and my friends and... I was a big, like, I loved soccer. I was a big Man United fan. I was a tomboy.
You're in Man United territory here, aren't you?
I'm like, good. I'm glad to hear it. But, you know, so I kind of, my early years felt good, you know. I didn't know any different. And I came from quite a solid household, which wouldn't have been... probably the same for like lots of my friends. There was quite a lot of diversity. So you had families that were in a position, I suppose, to like work or go on little holidays to Tramore in the summer. I suppose I fitted into that camp. Mm. So I had safety within my home. So my mum and dad went out to work most days. My mum was a machinist. And my dad worked in the same factory pressing clothes. He was a big sportsman, like, so he played like League of Ireland football and he was a referee until in his 60s. So we were always quite a sporting family. Mm-hmm. And there was no kind of addiction around in the household. Uh-huh. So we got to do the normal things like join clubs. And I realised much later on that maybe some of that stood to me being able to step outside of the kind of chaotic behaviour I would also be involved in mm-hmm. within the estate. And... I suppose school wasn't great for me. I know I was intelligent, but if I didn't see the point in something or the logic in something, I kind of dismissed it, and you know that would cause conflict, or I'd ask too many questions, or you know, too inquisitive, you know, or if I thought something was silly, I'd be saying it, you know. So obviously that doesn't go down well in school. And there's only so much of your character being kind of battered down in school where you then say, ah, fuck off. I don't want nothing to do with this, you know. But I was, primary school was fine for me. Secondary school was a bit different, you know. I think that can happen for a lot of kids. Yeah. Like you go from having the same people that you know your entire life to all these new...
It was the same for me. In primary school was fine.
Yeah.
It was a mixed school. It was in round the corner from my house. And then I went to an all-boys secondary school, Christian Brothers, in another area. I hated it. it's very hard to make that transition,
it
you
totally
know?
Is.
It's a big change.
It's I think we underestimate how hard it is.
And you're coming into puberty as well. There's a lot going on for you at that time. And secondary school was a nightmare for me.
You also have to find your group that you fit in with. You know, like on your book, I see the group that you fit in with. You fit in with people that you can actually feel comfortable around. And I, that's what happened to me. I felt very, very comfortable around certain people. And that's what really got me through it. You know, there's nothing we'd really change.
Totally. Like, I mean, people always ask me the things about my life I changed. And I, like, I always remember a counsellor that I had for years. Tommy, his name was, and he would say to me, in terms of, like, you know, people ask you, have you any regrets? What would you do differently? And even though I caused chaos throughout my life, and obviously I hurt people and I hurt my mom and dad and stuff, but he kind of taught me to accept all those parts of myself, because I was only a little girl and I was using the resources and tools that I had at the time to survive or to fit in or to get by. And obviously my intention at the time wasn't to hurt anybody, but I could only work with what I had, and I could only work within the environment in which I was in. And that it was still that young girl that made the decisions that led you to here. So if you begin regretting who she was, where would you be at all? Yeah, like, you
exactly
know?
Like where we are in our lives now after not being through some troubled years and addiction and stuff. But I wouldn't change it for the world, because the person I am today, so happy and content with my life and the knowledge and experience and character that we've built through the hardship, I wouldn't change it. Maybe there's certain regrets I might have. I might have done some stuff differently, like, but I wouldn't have wished an easy life, you know, because you don't get that character.
No, no, what that life does, it pushes you into this life. You know, you have to go through all that hardship, really. You know, all that pain and suffering and the loneliness. You know, the loneliness that you feel when you're on your own, when nobody wants you anymore after, you know, just being arrogant with all your family, but I understand completely,
Like, and I think then there's kind of a balance to be struck with between, because I think sometimes then I have to remind myself that it's really easy for, say, for me or for you to go, we don't regret that. But then if I was to ask some of my friends who are still living in the same life, they do regret it. And I'm like, okay, so the difference between me and them is that I managed to step out of it. So I think the biggest thing is, how do you make it possible for everybody to be able to be in the position you're in where you don't regret it, you know? And I think for me, I think sometimes, like, you know, I really have to remind myself, right, Lynn, you don't regret it and you wouldn't change a thing. But if you were still, like, on drugs, if you were still robbing cars, you would have all the regrets in the world, because, you know, you're saying you've no regrets from quite a position of privilege, not in the general societal sense, but privilege in terms of our own working class sense. You know, that kind of way.
Do you think that people like ourselves that have been through the mill and we're thriving now, do you think that we can be used as a rod to beat the people that haven't been able to step out of it? You know, we've a lot of friends still in addiction and still, you know, in the depths of it like we were. We're lucky enough that we got our break. And I think sometimes that we can be... why can't you do what James and Timmy is doing? But we're all different. We all have different challenges.
Exactly. And I think that that's one thing that I've always tried to push back against, is being heralded as some sort of, you know, weapon against your own community. And I think that can happen a lot with anyone that succeeds. But the thing is, none of us should be a story. Like, it shouldn't be, oh, look at these small few particular people were lucky enough to get a break, thereby why didn't anyone else do it? But the thing is, we got a break, or we used the skills that we had to try and take the break when we seen it. But that's not the same as everybody starting from the same social floor and having the same access to life and the same access to reach your full potential. Do you know what I mean? So we shouldn't be anomalies. It should be so normal for people not to end up in addiction in the masses and the way they do in their communities. It should be normal that we don't, you know, see education as some sort of triumph, like that it actually, it's just a normal thing for us to do.
See, a triumph in areas like your own and our own is, and I know you speak about this, if your son doesn't end up on drugs, like, if it's, you're minimising, oh, he only smokes hash, you're doing well. He's only having a few cans, you're doing well. He's after getting to the leaving cert, you're doing well. The bar is very low, like.
Yeah.
And because mothers are just struggling, and they might have three or four siblings there, might be on their own and a lone parent, and their job is put roof on the roof overhead and food on the table. And if they're, you know,
or even just being told, like, I'd just be happy if you even just got a trade or a job, you know, you're setting that standard there where the potential is, you know, limitless.
Society thinks that that's because, say, we don't care about thriving or succeeding, or we don't want to do well. But actually, what we do is we've told ourselves for years there's only so much that we can achieve. So we should only aim for that rather than our kids being disappointed. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, because we don't know anyone that's a pilot, or, you know, our next door neighbor isn't a psychiatrist, you know, or a consultant or whatever, you know. We choose then to try and go, well, what's the safest possible option for my child? You know, like some, like I, like there's some, there's like Halloween in our communities, I still get it, like a, you know, a little store in me, like, you know, one is excitement, but one is also, I wonder, is everyone going to be alive in the morning?
Yeah,
you know, stuff like that. Yeah. And when you're, when that's a successful day for a family in a community, you know, it's very hard to think about education or degrees or, you know, better jobs. It's like, can I get through Halloween night without my child being the one that comes home with a stab wound or something? Do you know
Halloween
what I mean?
Night was always a mad night for me. My birthday is Halloween night.
You went extra mad.
Yeah. Halloween night. Halloween night is a night of chaos. We've two nights in Cork. We've Halloween night is in October, obviously, and Bonfire Night, which is 23rd of June. And there are two nights where it's like the Purge. All bets are off, there's no rules. But you were talking about there about in communities where you've no doctors or psychiatrists or vets or whatever. And I hear you speaking before about, like sometimes I'd hear people, maybe not from around here, you have Susie grants now and you've all these grants and why can't everybody go to college like you? But it's not as simple as that. And it's not
financial.
It's not.
No.
So if you could, maybe for the people that's watching, so, tell us about maybe the, you know, the cultural capital, the social capital.
Yeah, so like it's so, first of all, if you've told yourself for years that something is not for you, it's very hard to come around to the idea. It's quite frightening. Like, you know, I watch kids in Dublin from Tala, and the idea of getting a bus every day to one of the colleges in the city centre feels like a really, really big thing, because you've literally grown up in a fishbowl, you know, and you own the only estates you recognize are the ones that are like on a bus route that you've taken to a particular place, you know, a few times. Like, I knew, like, from my house to Mount Joy on the bus, like, that was the longest journey I knew. I knew what buses to get, you know, I knew what parts of the roads I couldn't, like, roll joints on because you'd lose it at the back of the bus. Like, that was like, you know, that was the biggest journey I would do in my day to visit friends in St. Pat's and stuff. So the idea of going every day into this world of college and academia can seem like something really foreign. Like, people always used to say to me, like, be a bit confused when I'd say, I don't feel Irish. Like, I don't feel like I have a national identity. Mm-hmm. I feel very much like I'm Tala and that's all I am, you know, because I couldn't connect with anything outside of that. Because I'd no experience of anything outside of that. And so that's one thing that can be wrapped up in social and cultural capital, but also being able to engage with academia, engage with different types of language and the vocabulary. And, you know, we have a very particular dialect and we only learn so much in schools, and some of our schools can be a bit like crisis management more than actually flourishing education, like, you know. So we don't grow up reading particular texts or studying particular subjects. Like, if you want to be an engineer in Tala, the likelihood that you can access the software, so the, like, private schools or schools that have better resources use all the same software and stuff and buy the software that you would use in say Trinity if you were studying engineering. So you know what that looks like, where air schools have to take anything that's free. So they can. So there's no natural kind of progression from air schools into college that looks the same. So that can be quite frightening, you know. Accents, feeling different, feeling like you know, you don't belong, feeling like a fraud. Like, my dad grew up around the corner, and like when my uncle Noel was over from England when I was elected president of Students Union Trinity, he grew up in the tenements force on Usher's Quay, which is literally, you know, a stone's throw away from Trinity. And at 80 years of age, he stood in front square saying to me, "Oh, wow, this is amazing. I can't believe I was never in here before."
Yeah.
Dublin man, like, you know, and you're like, what the hell? But
even UCC is not far from here.
Yeah.
It's down Sund as well over the Shaky Bridge. You're in UCC. Yeah. It's about a 10-minute walk.
Yeah.
But it may as well have been a million miles away. And totally. I've said that before.
It's like a force field is around. I always explain it as like The Simpsons. You remember in The Simpsons movie when that globe comes over and they're all trying to figure out how to get out? Do you know what I mean? And it's like Susie Grant, right? Oh, yeah, right, okay, I'll apply for Susie. How do I do that? And then they go and they don't understand the form, and then they go to their mom and they say to their mom, "Can you help me do that?" And the mom's like, "Oh, I don't know. Ask your auntie," whatever, like, because they're petrified, because it's like there's this information deficit, this fear of all these forms, you know, and everybody just ends up pawning it off. And it's not because they don't care, it's because they're actually afraid to say, "I actually don't know what this is asking of me. I don't know how to fill this out. I don't know how to get all these forms that you need," you know. Or some people don't even know that the Susie Grant exists. Or they struggled when they're reading it to understand what the criteria is. You know, the amount of women that ring me every year to help them, like the amount of people, and like, I can only, that's only a drop in the ocean, you know. But, and then the pints is an issue, you know, people can't access college because it's set up against them from the offset. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's such an unequal exam to have to sit.
Even the Susie alone tried to fill that out.
Yeah.
I actually had to get help because that was probably one of the first application forms I ever filled out. I always got people to fill out medical card forms and all these different things because I didn't know how to. You know, I don't think I even knew what the PPS number was before that, before when I got sober and stuff, you know. And when I came across this thing then, I was baffled, the Susie application.
And it's just like a blur on the page.
But then they ask a lot of information about household income and all these things. Yeah. And like, we're afraid of all that stuff because, you know, sometimes we can't be too honest either. Yeah.
Well, you see, that's the thing. And like, I think we've grown up with this thing as well, that we're always doing something wrong.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's
kind of like, you know.
And the imposter syndrome then as well. Totally. I don't deserve this at all.
Yeah.
You know, when I was out in college, I would, like, when I was in prison, I got educated. I done my junior short and everything else. And when I got out, I went to college and I felt so out of my comfort zone. You know, I was like the fella on my own in the corner because I didn't know, like, I was around a lot of young people and there was some other mature
students.
They all
seem super confident.
Yeah.
And they're straight out of school, like.
There's this guy then, like, and he's like, the social, like, I just didn't feel like I was around my own. I was out of the fishbowl and I wasn't around my own people. No, it was just how I felt. It wasn't that I wasn't around my own people. It was just, I was so used to being up here in our little bubble and not being outside speaking to other people. It was very, very difficult, you know.
Yeah, like, even, like, when I was in college, thankfully, like, I had, there was something about me or my character that I built over the years that I wasn't too offended by people asking me questions or people like being a bit shocked even sometimes, say, by my humour. That's the one I think the most. Like, people ask about your accent in college and I'm like, no, but like, apparently my humour is pretty fucking sick. It's like, I think I laugh at like all the wrong things or all the violent things. And I remember we blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
hell? You know what I mean? It's like, that was the biggest thing that got me when people would be like, looking at me with this like baffled face, and I'm like, "Oh, that's not funny, isn't it?"
No,
in certain places, it wouldn't be like.
No. Do you know what I mean? So I think like the working class humor just sometimes has no boundaries on how dark it can go, like, but really intelligently dark and witty. Do you know what I mean? I think it's one of the best sense of humors ever. But in some spaces, you realize how different your life experiences were, you know, from other people. So I think that's what I missed the most in my day, was that just having that kind of wicked kind of like sense of humour or buzz with somebody, like, do you know what I mean? Although I probably, if I had like some of my mates in my class with me, I probably never would have got a thing done, like, do you know what I mean? Because I think I still romanticise about my teenage years, and I definitely go straight back there with my friends, like, do you know what I mean? With the giddiness and the stories and the storytelling, like, you know, I'm so much, I have the most fun when I'm with my working class pals. Yeah.
Occasionally, you know, we'd meet up, a few of us in recovery, you know, we'd be friends from childhood.
Yeah.
The last time, you know, we went camping down Killarney for the night, there was about 25 of us. But we're like a lot of teenagers when we get together. Everybody is comfortable. There's no judgment. We all know who we are and where we come from.
Yeah.
There's not, it's just a very comfortable environment. And it's great to have that outlet every few months, you know, and tap back into that, because we can work from the adult all the time. And in, you know, in the office and in academia and professional settings. But it's great to just tap into, you know, who we really are.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
Totally,
yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, but one thing you were saying there, you know, about Trinity and about CIT, I remember my first day, one of my first days in UCC, I think I might have done the MSAP or something, one of the first experiences on campus that were actually doing the election campaign for the Students' Union. And it was like walking through an American teen movie. I was looking at these young ones and young fellas. I was like, what the fuck is going on? It was like a totally new world to me. And then all these slogans, rolling with all in vote number one. And I was like, oh my God.
I remember looking at them out in the CIT when they were doing the votes and stuff, and they were getting up on top of the stage, and there might have been about 1,500 students watching them inside in the canteen. And I was saying, oh, is he up there talking in front of, like, I didn't have that kind of confidence.
But you know, when we were younger, we thought they were fucking idiots.
Yeah.
And you know what? They're the people that run the country. Yeah. And you know, if I look at the young people in UCC today, they have the best parties, they have the best social life, they come out with good jobs. But when we were that age, we just thought that they were losers. And that was the relationship we had with UCC. And if we walk through UCC when you're 16, 17, security's coming on to move you out of it. Thinks you're robbing bikes and stuff like that, which probably
wouldn't have been wrong either.
There's always a bit of truth in the stereotype, isn't there?
You have to get money to feed the habit somewhere. Like, yeah, you know, well, that's how it was.
Yeah.
But can I ask you a little bit now? So you went through Trinity.
Yeah.
You didn't just go through Trinity. You were the president of the Students' Union.
I was.
And out of that, you were elected to Shannon.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience, maybe your first few days in the Shannon? Were you confident going in there, or did confidence grow as you went along?
Yeah, I think I've always been quite good at faking for a period of time until it feels natural, you know. So people are always quite shocked when they realise that I've probably spent a couple of months having to, like, you know, like being a bit exhausted after a few months because I've been like mentally kind of focused on going, I'm grand at this, I'm good at this, and nobody can really tell that I'm like scared or, you know. And I suppose in Trinity, the first time I felt quite scared was the getting up and talking and asking for votes. Like, I was like, why, how can I ask somebody to vote for me? It nearly felt like shame.
Mm.
And I'm like, why do I feel shame asking someone to vote for me? And it was like asking people to have like confidence in me, to believe in me, to be honest, a part of me was trying, kind of rejecting that. And I was kind of like, I'm a fucking idiot. Like, I mean, why are you asking anyone for that? You don't fucking even need to do that. You know what I mean? Yeah, so it's like I was asking them for something for nothing, like, you know, with me handout or something. And it was an election and everyone else bigging themselves up, and I'm like, what's wrong with me? I'm struggling with this. And I had never publicly spoke to that many people, like, because it could be anything from like 400 people in a lecture hall, you know. Yeah. And I remember being rattling inside. And after the first day, my campaign manager, who was from Crumlin and came through the Access programme with me, there was only about three of us in the campaign. By the end of it, everyone had dropped their candidates and joined their campaign. But at the start, like, I would literally, my stomach, I would have the runs for days at the thought of even, oh God, I have to go on that talk now, and I have pains up my neck. And and then the second day, third day, I think it was, into the campaign, there's like this big kind of speech out on the dining hall steps, and it's out in Front Square. And Rob said, right, let's go over your speech. And I says, no, I'm just going to go tell it on the. And he's like, I don't know what that means. And I'm like, I'm just going to go tell it on them. Like, I'm just going to go community worker and tell it on them. At the end of the day, this is a community, isn't it? Like, aspirations are aspirations. And whether you're upper class or working class, there is certain things that people want. Mm. And I just need to go up and talk about that. And I went up and I just dropped the idea of having to try and talk about these policies or what I was going to do for Trinity or da 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 da. And I just spoke about community and I spoke about equality and diversity and inclusion and what that means. And that just spoke to so many people, because whether you were disabled or, you know, whether you had a disability, whether you were, you know, on the autism spectrum, or whether you were a migrant student, or whether you were, you know, there because you travelled from some other European country to be there, there was something about in the speech that I gave that kind of pulled everybody in, which was really quite empowering. So that was the kind of most frightened I felt, was the first day or two before I kind of just relaxed and was me. I think I was rejecting who I was the first 2 days, trying to sound like the other candidates or something, and that made me feel really ill. And then when I went into the Senate, it was hard. It was actually harder than going into Trinity for some reason, because it's so much more concentrated and there's cameras on you all the time. I didn't know if I could stop cursing for long enough to actually do a speech. Yeah. I didn't know how I was going to dress.
Yeah, I've seen you on the channel before wearing your Air Max and showing your tattoos, which is fantastic. Yeah. You know?
I definitely had to push that, you know.
Yeah, is it a hard thing to do that? Like,
yeah, it was, because people are commenting on the first day or two. They're so used to a particular, like, a suit is not my uniform. Do you know what I mean? And I kind of think, like, people wearing suits, that's okay, they're comfortable in that. But like the idea that people should wear suits and work, or women should wear particular types of kind of work looking dresses or trouser suits, where did that come from? Like, you know, it's not what I wear on a day to day basis. It's not what I wear and what I'm comfortable in. And, you know, I really had to push back against that. And I arrived in my first day to speak in the Shannon. Now, we'd been in for a while the programme of government was being, but I arrived in like this, it was really sunny, and I arrived in this little like summer dress with all my tattoos out, but it was quite short as well, so it meant all my leg tattoos were shown as well. So I was just like, just fucking go in and embrace it. And there was a couple of comments, and you can see like that people are just not used to it in there, you know. And I think, but it kind of got, they got used to it. You know, and I remember telling the story before, but I had like this recurring dream for about 2 or 3 nights that I bought this like Tommy Hilfiger suit in Grafton Street. And I was like navy, and it's not something I would wear. Like, and in the dream, I kept putting it on and going in to speak for my maiden speech in the Shannon. And I kept turning into Mickey Mouse fleecy pajamas. Every time I stood up to speak, and I'd run back to the office to try and put the suit back on. But every time I spoke, and this kept happening, and I was like, and that was kind of like the sign to me, Jesus, Lynn, is there something subconscious going on here? Are you afraid to speak? You know, are you afraid that you're going to stand out, or your accent? Sometimes I get words completely wrong, you know, and I've had to embrace that. You know, at first I used to get embarrassed, like when someone would try and correct me word, where now I just say, yeah, did you know what I meant? So like, fuck off. Like, exactly. What are you correcting me for? Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now I had to work hard to embrace that my dialect, and go, do you know what? There's some words that I say that you know the meaning of, I know the meaning of, I say them differently, you know, and I'm not going to reject that part of me, you know?
Yeah.
And, but what's funny is, like, you know, Seb, my assistant, would write speeches for me sometimes. Like, if I'm too busy, or if it's not a subject that I feel that I can do justice to just speak and ad lib on, he would write. But sometimes he puts in words, and I'm like, I get to it in the middle of the speech, and I go, oh my god, what is that? What is that word? And you can say it in your head because you're used to reading it, but you've never ever said it in a conversation.
Yeah.
So actually, you're not really sure how it's pronounced.
Yeah.
And they're moments like I've had to kind of just laugh off, you know. But so
was there ever times that you felt like you had to be like the other people in the Shannon, that you had to behave in their way and speak like them?
Yeah, you know? And I definitely. There's definitely times where I have had to kind of really talk to myself. But I even got that in Trinity. Like, I remember writing an economics essay once and going home before I handed it in and reading over it and going, that is the most conservative fucking essay I have ever written. What's going on? And I had to scrap it and remind myself that I'm being taught in an institution that has taught in a conservative or a right-wing economics, you know. It's not social economics. It doesn't take into, you know, it's very clinical. It's, you know, so there's times where you have to kind of catch yourself going, Jesus, I didn't know I was at being conditioned a little bit there, or I'm at the picking up a behaviour, or I'm at the, you know, there's something, but my friends are quick to pull me up on it, you know, and they're quick to kind of go, Lynn, I don't know what you're saying. And I really have to watch that, because my whole thing is that I'm not middle upper class in terms of my culture, and I'm probably not deemed as working class in terms of my access or my resources, or, you know, so, but I am very much culturally still working class, and I still live in Killinard, and I still live in my ma's house. Do you know what I mean? Like I'm hanging on to it for dear life, you know, but I do exist somewhere in the middle of that. And I want, you know, I want educated academics, or, you know, professionals, or the legal profession, or the judiciary, or anybody, I want them to understand what I'm saying and learn something from it. But I also want to continue to talk in a way that my community and the people I care and love about know what the fuck I'm saying and can still relate to me. So it's a very fine line to try and walk, especially when you're the Trinity senator, but you're the woman from Talla, and you're trying to manage those two worlds. So sometimes I do find myself sounding or whatever, or trying to behave in a different way in front of particular people, but it's probably because I'm trying to cradle two sides of a coin, and I'm trying to do it with like ease, without pissing either side off too much. You know,
because you can drift away from your own people when you start using the other people's language. You know, that actually happened to me as well in the college. Like I was leaning towards the professional side of construction. And I was getting more and more uncomfortable as I was going there. And I said, well, hold up 1 minute. Try yourself back now and go back to your own community where you feel comfortable. It's not about being up here or doing all this. You know, there was one thing I wanted to mention there. You spoke about when you were up in the stage giving the speech in Trinity for the election. You know, and I was thinking, and you said, I'm going to be myself. Just be myself. I'm going to go with. And just something clicked into my mind. There was a section of your book where this guy just walked into one of the youth centres that you worked in when you were younger. And he came in and he just said, I was told to come here because of Lynn. You know, like, because I was told Lynn would look after me. And I just, whoa, like, that was a lovely thing to hear. It actually brought a tear to my eye because, like, you were actually looked upon back then as somebody that you can go out to Lynn, and that's what I'm getting. Yeah. I'm getting a picture of you're somebody that people in your community can come to. They know you'll speak to them properly, and that must be very, very nice for you to feel that way as well. Like,
yeah, you know? It is, and I think that's the difference between the space I'm in now and then, where when I was working directly with people, you know, like with the lad that you talk about, or anybody that I worked with in the addiction services, or when I worked in the homeless services, you never found me in the office. I was always in someone's fucking, getting given out to because I was in someone's bleeding bedroom or fucking pool room or TV room, you know, and always in the middle of the banter with the lads and getting to know them and stuff. And, even though their lives were in such chaos, especially as well in the addiction field, you could see the impact that you were having, even if it was slow and incremental, but you could see, but in politics, it's very hard to know if you're having an impact and get that same sort of feedback. Like, I forget what name I gave him in the book now, so I'm not going to name him, the one you're talking about. So when you're getting on the spot feedback that you're valued, or that you're good at your job, or that this person you can help. And it feels great to know that there was people out there directing him to me and saying, you won't be rejected there because of the position you're in, because he was getting this kind of, just put out of the hospital. He was in severe psychosis at the time, you know, and to know that he sought me out, it gives you a good feeling. And I think people always are afraid to acknowledge that what we do is not some sort of selfless, heroic goal. You do get something out. If you're the type of person that likes to help people, there is a reward for that. And you do feel good about that. And it's okay to feel good about helping people. You know, you don't have to make out that it's something selfless and you don't get anything from it. And you go home drained and, you know, you're just out there trying to save everybody, you know. And that's not what it is at all, because there's a part of my identity that needs to know that I'm helping.
But you know what as well, Lynn? you know, when you go through that life as well, you can have that little bit of compassion and empathy for the person on the other side.
Yeah, and it's a lack of fear. You're not exactly afraid what of they're going through. You're not afraid of people's trauma.
Exactly.
And pain and madness. And
and there's no judgment there, because you could just as easily be still sitting on the other side of the chair.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one thing that we have there is for people that are still struggling in addiction and are still out there homeless, you know, you just, you have that little bit of compassion, and anytime you see them, you just, like, you know what they're going through, totally. And you wish them the best.
And I think,
but you can't do nothing from, you know.
And I think that's why we're failing so many people, because we keep so many people, like, goes out of the careers that can help them. So, like, if the social work department in Tusla looked like our communities and had a load of working class men and women, I think, or, you know, therapy spaces, health spaces, but there's not enough working class people in there. So there's this big divide between people that need help and the people that are providing the help, you know, and they might mean well, but you can mean well all you want. If you can't actually relate to the group that you're trying to support, it's very hard to penetrate into that space. Do you know what I mean? And like, you know, it's, I'm at a losing my train of thought there.
I was going to butt in there anyway, because let's say if me and Timmy, right, we've been through the mill, as I said earlier on, and we're in a privileged position now where we're educated and we're trying to give back. But let's say we did a social work degree, we would not get a job at Tusla. That's very disheartening, and it's very disappointing, because you have a lot of people out of touch with reality of living in these areas, and they come in and they make clinical judgments because they have no empathy. They can't be in your shoes. They don't know what it's like to have.
And sometimes they overreact.
Yeah.
And I can see they might come in and go, oh my God, this place is blah, blah, blah. And you're going, actually, this is actually the quiet road.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? So the judgment calls you make are a little greyer, a little nicher, a little more insightful. Like, I mean, working in the homeless services, I really seen that you had well-meaning people who cared, right? But they came from backgrounds that didn't experience what we had experienced or what the lads had experienced. And I'm saying lads because it was mostly men in the homeless sector when I started out. And you would see people being turned away or put out a hostel for using heroin in their room, right? And I used to be baffled. I used to go, I was with you when we assessed him, when that person came in. He goofed off the whole way through the assessment. Right? Why are we putting him out? He was like, this is why people are homeless. They're homeless because they're in addiction. They have mental health issues. Yeah. And as soon as they show you any signs of that, you want to put them out of hostel. Mm. Where's the logic in that? But they're afraid.
Yeah,
they're actually afraid. Like, I mean, I'd see people having like mental health episodes within the hostels. Like, there was one guy I remember, and they were like, he was only given the bed, and they're already warning all the staff now in the last hostel. So they're all backing off. So I'm straight out, and he's trying to pebble at a pigeon or something in the portrait, and I was like, yeah, oh fucking, and he was like, what? And I was like, the two of us had this big fucking fight in the doorway about the pigeon, and I was asking, well, do you think that pigeon can feel? Like, if you had to hit him with that, do you think he can feel that? And this, we got into this big philosophical conversation then about what animals can and can't feel, about pain, emotion, and it was kind of heightened, and I was shouting and he was shouting. And then I went back in, and the next day I got called into the manager's office, right? And this guy then really took to me, like, do you know what I mean? Everyone else was afraid of him because he had schizophrenia. He was triggered by certain colours. I just asked him, what colours? What colour clothes should I not wear in here? He says, just don't ever wear red. Like, I'll make sure I do that. But everybody else is pushing in the fucking about, you know, and not engaging with him.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to create a monster, well, then that's what you do. If you want someone to react, whisper in the corners, acknowledge that they know yous are all avoiding him because yous are afraid he's going to have some sort of violent outburst because of some history you've read on a computer of some last hostel he was in, without any context of who might have triggered anything in him, how he's been minded in his trauma, you know, what actually, you know, when is the schizophrenia at its most heightened, you know, learn and understand about his mental health. But instead they would, like, they called me and I got scolded, like, for engaging in a debate about the pigeon.
Yeah.
And I'm like, come on. And I think that that's what the problem is. I'm not afraid to walk into someone's, and I think that none of us that have experienced lives where they can be unpredictable like that, you're ready for the unpredictableness, you understand trauma, you're not really afraid to approach the hard subjects.
Yeah.
You know, they were all in there trying to fucking, like,
I remember I was working in homeless services here in Cork too, and my first day in the job, this girl overdosed, right? Now, I'd seen a million overdoses in my day. I was grand, you know, cool, go through the protocol, whatever. And afterwards, the staff were like, fuck it, James, you were grand there. No, I was anonymous at the time, in there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, if you only fucking knew now, do you know how many overdoses I stood over like that on my own with a paramedic and loudspeaker down an alley or something, you know?
He's just stayed.
Yeah.
Me trying to convince people to stay when someone not, no, stay. But I have loads of charges. Yeah. Stay till the ambulance get there and then leg it.
Or else you find as well, a lot of staff would be afraid of travellers.
Yeah.
Not with travellers in homeless services.
Yeah.
I'm not letting him in or I'm not going up. But I'm well used to travellers because we grew up with travellers. Yeah. My wife is from a traveller family herself.
Yeah.
But there's no, it's all xenophobia. It's just a fear. Yeah,
totally.
Because, but like, and if I'm going up then and I'm chatting with the traveller, now might be heightened, but he's heightened like a settled person would be heightened.
Exactly.
He's not like Hercules.
Yeah.
He's not the Hulk when he gets heightened. He's still a human. And I go up and I'd be chatting to him because there's no fear. Why would you be fearful of them? Just people. Like,
but I think if you keep placing your own fears on people, you nearly create something in that person to react. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like I think people create the environment for people to lash out. And I think it's so unfair. It's such a power play. Like, do you know what I mean? Because you have so much power as a worker to put them out and they have no power, but yet you're afraid of them, but yet you keep making decisions on their day, whether they have a bed, where they go, where they eat, if they eat, you know, but yet you're afraid of them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a horrible atmosphere to be in, isn't it?
Can I bring you back to the small bit there? We were talking about not being able to get a job in Toastland here, just seeing stuff like that with convictions. But it's not just there. There's loads of places.
Yeah.
They'll just, they'll filter you out of applications if you have a conviction and the other five candidates don't. And I know you've done great work in the Shannon, but do you meet a lot of resistance when you're trying to get through a bill like that, that maybe the rest of the senators might be close to their hearts?
I think we've done a huge amount of work in the last Shannon to bring people around. We've done a huge amount of research and I've tried to do my politics in a way that I could just get a bill drafted and table it, right? And then make a big fuss. Oh, they voted against this bill, da 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 da. And I don't really see the point in doing that. If I really want to get something passed, I need to put in the work before I table the bill. So I need to spend time trying to educate people maybe that don't understand why the expungement of convictions is a problem, why they don't understand how it's like stopping people being able to move on with their lives, that people are punished forever. They basically have their human rights removed forever in terms of employment, education, even volunteering on their child's GAA club or soccer or whatever, going on a trip with the boxing club or whatever, you know, that you're getting guard vetted at every port of call now. And so we spent a good year and a half trying to gain enough insight, research, working with people who have convictions, working with the Irish Penal Reform Trust, and then also holding lots of briefings within Leinster House where we would invite TDs, ministers and their staff and senators to briefings to educate them on what this meant and why this bill was important. So we've done all that groundwork first, which meant we done quite well moving the bill through. When I bring it back now, it'll be gone into its fifth stage. But the problem is when you have an election before you get it through all stages is I now have to, I have a lot of all these new people to win over again, you know. And Charlie Flanagan, who's a Cork man, is he? No, he's Leash. So Charlie Flanagan was really supportive, you know. And sometimes people surprise you, you know, you think like, oh, there's no way and, you know, it's going to be all about law and order or, you know, but he got it and we worked very closely with the Justice Department behind the scenes. We never surprised them. So if I was going to amend the bill, I would ring them a few weeks before and say, listen, I'm going to put this amendment through to the bill, which actually makes it even more liberal or, you know. So I just try and work collaboratively so that everybody is part of the process, that it's not just my thing. Do you know what I mean?
In an ideal scenario, what would your bill look like? What would the law look like for you?
So basically it would remove the cap on how many convictions could be spent. So endless convictions could be spent. And people's fear on that is that, what if you re-offend? And then it's like, well, it takes a year or two for it to come off. So if you're still re-offending, you'll keep it. It will constantly show up. But if you haven't offended for a year or 2 years, like the trying to get the smallest minimum amount of wait time, so you're removing the 7 year threshold, and you're also introducing proportionality. So if you were only given a probation or a particular fine or a particular really small sentence, well, then you shouldn't be waiting as long as the person that maybe done 12 months. You know, maybe there's a 6 month period or a year. I haven't got the proportion table in my head. But so it's kind of looking at proportionality. But it means then that you have numerous chances to stop offending. So it means you stop judging people on the many offences they have, and you judge them on the fact whether they're not offending. So you look at that bit. You look at, are these not offending? Okay, well, then we can remove the convictions. Do you know what I mean?
I think it could be a great incentive for somebody trying to go straight as well, somebody coming into recovery. If I stick it out, I'd actually be rewarded at the end of this, because I might get a fresh start.
I have friends in recovery with PhDs and they can't get jobs. Some of my friends have said to me the worst thing they ever done was get an education when they got off drugs, because they're more miserable and depressed now understanding how the system is stacked against them than they were when they were completely oppressed by it and didn't realise how much the machine of society was kind of locking them out. But that awareness and then still being locked out is kind of depressing.
And to move on. Sorry, James.
Sorry, fine.
And just to move on with your life, you know, say, for instance, now someone like me or James or anybody else to get sober and start to begin change all their behaviours and going down the route of education.
It's lonely.
And you're 6 or 7 years down the line and you get your degree or your master's or whatever, and you want to go into a line of work. And then you hit this wall, bang on, and you're told you can't have the job. You know, and you're saying, what was the whole point?
What was the point in it? What was the point? And you nearly want to go, well, why the fuck am I sober?
Do you know what I mean? Exactly. Do you know what I mean?
So you then start looking like, no wonder.
Yeah. You know, but that would be part of the bill as well. We'd actually ban the box. It would make you wouldn't be allowed to ask on an application form whether somebody has a conviction.
Yeah.
So it doesn't mean that you can't ask them later on in the process. But you can't ask them on the point of the application form, which means that you at least get to the interview point so you can actually talk about your skills, talk about your education, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And then it's also, I'd love a socioeconomic discrimination piece in it, and we have done that somewhat, but it's about being, even if your conviction is spent, and sometimes it still comes up. So if you're discriminated against based on the fact that you have a conviction, and your conviction is irrelevant to the job that you're applying for, well, then there should be a case there on the grounds of discrimination. If you're perfectly qualified for the job and they were going to offer you the job or something, and then the Garda Veteran came back. So if your stuff was for robbing, for shoplifting, but you're going in to work in, like, you know, social work or some tech company or whatever, what relevance has any of that got to the fact that you're doing this job? Yeah. So the only things that should ever be taken into account is, like, you know, obviously they have like violent crimes and multiple violent crimes. And I still have an issue with that as well, because sometimes we get involved in violence.
There's a context.
There's a context as well. So there's, like, it's very hard. There's also the cases that I it'll probably be years before I try and address them, because I don't think people are ready to have that discussion yet. But, like, somebody that commits manslaughter at like 13 or 14 years of age, it could have been that they were in a fight. It definitely was. It wasn't the intent of the argument. They're not even, like, they're only children. They haven't fucking fully formed. It's impulsive. It's reactionary. And they never have a chance to apply for that to be removed in any shape or form to travel, even though they were only like minors, you know, and maybe they never even offended again, you know, ever. Yeah. You know, so there's all these different really hard contexts that them conversations are not having it yet. But going back to your original question about how hard it is to get that bill in, it seemed like at the time when I was bringing it in the last, Shannon, people understood why it needed to happen, and people listened, and people get it, and it makes sense. And, you know, recidivism is so high. Like, if you want to reduce recidivism, you need to give people a way to be able to live their lives, and you need to be able to get them to, when they get their master's or their degree, to be able to, or even some people are Garda vetted for a social work degree, so they sometimes won't even get that far. You know,
I remember when I started out with my youth and community degree, I had a conviction for drugs from 2014 in April, and I started a bachelor's degree in September 2014. And it's 50% of it is in college and 50% on placement, you know. Found it very hard to get a placement. Now the conviction was from a few months before, but defence actually happened in 2012.
Exactly.
And yeah. I was after doing a ton of work on myself, in nearly a year in treatment, nearly a year aftercare, and NA meetings every day. I was a different person, but they didn't care. On the paper, the conviction was from 2014, so I don't know if there was ever a way, and even though this is not what we should be aiming for, but if there was a... on the Garda Veteran, the date of the crime, because sometimes we do have discussions
about that, and there is a few, like, there's a lot of people when I start working on this contacted me because they were refused their placements. I had a young girl from Limerick. I had a few different colleges, people ringing me from, and me then trying to find them placements, dealing with the colleges. But what we need to do is raise the awareness and understanding of employers that they don't, they're making the discriminatory decision. The Garda Veteran form might say one thing, but you can ignore that.
Of course you can, yeah. It's not a filter, you still have the decision.
No, so you should get people, like people should have an understanding and be able to listen and let someone make their case as to, like you saying it was 2012, I've done this and that, and they should be able to take that on board and make the right decision based from there. But people are just going, no. And it's like never understanding the context, never giving a person an opportunity to discuss the matter, and really just excluding people. So I think a whole, whatever about the legislation, there needs to be a whole body of work about educating employers about being able to make smart decisions when they come up against this thing.
And I think that's a big motivation for this podcast as well. Yeah. Like, I know when Timmy was coming to the end of his degree, he just finished in construction management. He was very insecure about, and he can speak for himself. But this is a way, and when I went down the television and doing this, but putting it all out there, this is who we are. We shouldn't be ashamed of who we are. We were in survival mode a lot at the time, and we can't be judged in the same morality as somebody that has a father on a quarter.
Access to everything. Yeah.
Exactly. And like, we've owned it, and we're trying to do as best we can now to move on and to be positive role models in our community. And now it's up to the employer and everybody else to just meet us halfway.
You can only be socially and morally responsible if your basic needs are met. And if your basic needs are met and you're working from a lower social foundation than everybody else, well, then that society would try and hold you to this really high standard of morality and social conscience and all of that. But yet people that do have access to the world, to education, make bad decisions all the time, and you're judged, and they're not judged with the same fucking morality stick that you are. You only have to look at the court system and the prison system to see that. Do you know what I mean? The administrative side of how the laws are implemented, and class bias is massive. Do you know what I mean? Even in relation to spent convictions, and also in relation to drugs offences.
Because
you're more likely to have a drugs offence if you're from a working class community, and that's just because you're more likely to come up against a guard as you walk out of your house.
Of course you are.
You know?
Even like in UCC here for Rag Week, the south side of the city next to UCC is chaos. Like, the students go mental and the residents have their heart broke over there. There could be riots over there, hundreds of people born on wheelie bins. The guards will come in and move people on. Bonfire night or Halloween night, the same thing happens up here. There's paddy wagons being filled and the courts are being filled.
Yeah.
And even if a student does, and it doesn't happen all the time, even if a student does get arrested, the case is made before the judge in the district court. Oh, he's doing a degree and he's going to be an engineer. You're going to ruin these prospects, just give him a chance. But if you're from Knocknaheeny or Tala, he's not going to amount to anything anyway, give him the conviction. And it's not explicit, but it happens all the time.
Totally.
And we're policed differently.
Mm.
So
such a waste of time as well, bringing people to court and costs of solicitors and...
We spoke with William McMahon there a few weeks ago. He speaks very highly of you, actually.
Does he?
But he was telling us it's 340 grand a year to keep a young person in Orbiston and 90 odd grand a year to keep somebody in prison. Imagine what you would do with that money early in the community.
And look how many of them charges are drug related for small amounts of drugs. We're sending people to prison and we're just wasting funds that could be put into addiction centres and other different...
Yeah.
But even, like, I'm a big, for me, on a personal level, I think if we want to put money into something, put it into the kids, the younger
prevention.
Kids.
Like, you know? If you think of every man that's in prison, if they had have had 90 grand invested in them as a young child for their journey through life, at this stage, I would pay people to go to college and go to school. I would take all those 90 grand and I would take the poorest communities and I'd pay the families for getting their kids to school and college. I'd pay the kids to go to college. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would literally finance it and incentivize it. And gradually the people then realize, like, then you change a whole generation. Like, so you have to change a whole generation holistically, the whole family. Do you know what I mean? So that the intergenerational stuff doesn't just keep repeating itself. And you need to be able, like, one person can transcend their class, but it's only when you can transcend a whole community do you really make any real societal change. So I would take all that money that's in the justice system, that's in the legal aid, that's in the prison system, and how you could actually invest that at a community level to be able to change a whole generation of prospects for young people and their families. You know, I think... like, it just makes so much more sense. That doesn't keep anyone in their job. Do you know what I mean? And people start fulfilling their own needs when they work in particular sectors as well, you know? So, like, you know, poverty is an earner for a lot of people, and poverty is a sector, you know? And that's really sad to think about that, you know?
I know. And look, just before we finish up, because we're on an early hour now, and I don't want the battery going dead in the camera. I know you had a child when you were quite young.
Yeah.
If you had any bit of advice for maybe a teenager that's pregnant or have a child at the moment, and I don't know, they might think that their prospects in life aren't great. Yeah. Have you any kind of few words for them, or maybe parents?
I think accepting a person's situation. I think what I learned from my own parents was they accepted the situation very, very quickly, and they rode in behind me. I know that everybody is in that position, and their family situation might be different, or they might, you know, but I think if I look at my daughters now, one who's 13 and one who's 20, and even though it's not my idea for them to get pregnant right now, and I'd like them to get their degrees and all that kind of stuff, I think I would have to do what my mum and dad do and go, right, this is the situation. How do we make the best of this? This is the reality, and we just need to support and help. And I think that's more of a message to families about rallying around young people to support them. But I think for a young mother, I think it's hard, because it's hard to have one single universal message when you know everyone's situation is so different. But for me, obviously, engaging in education on Kasan at 16 was a huge help. But they also had childcare, so it made it easier for me. So I don't think I can give the young person a message that would make sense to everyone other than them knowing that they can do what they want to do. My message would be more to the community and society to actually make sure that there's places within communities that young women can go and have access to childcare while they learn or while they work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think it's too much responsibility for me to tell a young girl to do this or that if that doesn't exist. So I'd more put the responsibility back on society and, you know, the environment to be able to create space for young women to succeed. And I think my story reflects that when you have that can happen, you know. And Ankasan and my parents' support was huge in me being able to give myself enough foundation that I at least didn't feel like I was sinking or that I was alone, even though I was still messed up. I think that's the thing.
Yeah.
People herald me as if I've done this amazing thing. My kids' lives wasn't easy.
Mm.
I might now be able to sit here and talk about our lives, but it wasn't easy. I was still traumatised. I still felt a huge amount of anger right up until I was 30. I still cursed and screamed and shouted around the house and made mistakes. And my kids would sometimes be crying and going, oh, ma, stop, calm down. You know, so I think that would be my message, is that there's not this one idea of what a mother should be and can be. And if you've experienced hardship or trauma, you need to allow yourself to heal while also parenting. And it's very hard and it's difficult to parent without shame when you're also struggling with mental health. And I think that is the biggest thing I can tell someone, is that no mother is perfect. And, you know, if they're like me and they came with all the baggage that I came with, it's taken a long time for me to shed the shame of me not being able to be what I thought a mother was supposed to be and provide. But I still managed to get us here.
Yeah.
And it was who I was as a working-class woman that done that, not any other idea of what I thought I was supposed to be, you know.
Brilliant. Do you know that section of your life, and just before we finish up, I think this is important, do you know, when you were in that Ankushkan, is it?
Ankushkan, yeah.
I think meditation became a big part of your life, and that's what saved me as well.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a person for retaining information and understanding it properly. But when I went down the route of meditation, and I was able to, instead of going into my head, I was able to feel all these emotions coming up, all that stuff that was blocked down. That's when my life changed. So anytime I was having a bad day and the negative thinking came on, I could grasp it immediately and feel it, whereas before I'd go down.
Act on it and react on it. I think meditation was introduced to me very young, and I, at 15, 16, I probably resisted it a little bit then, but I was curious about it. But it was probably, like I said, I was still 15 and I was still a mother. I was still like, what are these fucking bleeding weirdos trying to have me do, sit here meditating? Dopes. Do you know what I mean? So I was still just a young one from Tala, trying to be a man, do you know what I mean? Resisting anything good that was offered to me, but still turning up, you know? And, but meditation and visualization, I think, was a really big one for me. And I think sometimes I say to myself, Jesus, I must be a bit of a narcissist, am I? Like, you know, I just keep going, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to write a film. And it's like, you've never even done any of those things or studied any of those things. But what, and I was like, no, Lynn, you're not just someone that thinks they can do anything and be brilliant at everything. It's just that idea of visualization, going, well, do you know what? I'm going to give it a try. Do you know what I mean? And a kind of succeed. And so I think the meditation was powerful for me, but the visualization piece was the biggest, the biggest thing that I introduced, I think, into my life as a teen.
Yeah, that was your safe place. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. So we're going to finish up now, Lynn.
Thank you.
Thanks a million.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
It's been fantastic. I really enjoyed listening to you. It's a pleasure to meet you, finally. I watched you from mainly Twitter, or read your book and everything. So it's great to meet you in person. Very nice. And I'm sure the people watching will get a laugh from it.
Yeah.
And thank you for representing the likes of myself and Timmy fighting the cause for people with convictions and people that's on drugs, and for being a voice for the working class in the Shannon. So thanks a million for
that. Thank you.
And to the people that's watching, thanks a million for watching and supporting us. And for all those people that contacted us looking for help that were struggling, I hope you're doing okay today.
Yeah.
And if you're not, get in touch. We link in with more supports. We're not therapists or counsellors, but we know a lot of people who are, and we can be a hub of information for you. So get in touch if you're struggling, get in touch to us with your comments and feedback, and we'll see you next week. Slán.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.